You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a group of musicians who are helping to promote inclusion and equality in the Madison music scene. First, environmental groups in the Ho-Chunk Nation are bringing the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to court. They're challenging the DNR over the agency's approval of a permit that would allow a frac sand mining operation to fill a wetland in Monroe County. Rich Kramer joins us now. He's a WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, on what grounds is this case being brought to court?
Basically, the three groups are upset with the DNR for approving a permit that they said was incomplete. But really, the bigger picture here is that they're trying to stop the filling of 16 acres of what has been described as pristine hardwood swamp wetlands in Monroe County. So these are wetlands that the group Midwest Environmental Advocates says are very hard to come by in Wisconsin. A lot of it has already been destroyed, so they're trying to protect what's left.
Well, tell us about the company involved and their project that would fill in this wetland.
The company involved is Atlanta-based Meteor Timber. Some years back, Meteor Timber bought a huge amount of property in Wisconsin. I think technically they're the largest private landholder in the state. They bought something like 50,000 acres or more. Then, not long ago, in 2014, I believe, they realized that part of this property in Jackson County and in Monroe County was right above a nice deposit of some frac sand, industrial sand used for hydraulic fracture drilling. So they started working on a plan to get at it. The plan is to build a mine and then truck the sand to this property in Monroe County, where they want to build a rail facility. After they wash the sand, they need to put it directly to rail to ship it, because that's more cost effective than trucking it to another facility.
Before we dig deeper into this case, let's take a step back. Rich, you've been following this frac sand industry in Wisconsin. It was a big booming industry. Where does it stand now?
Well, it was booming like gangbusters. I don't know if that's the right term, but in 2014, it was really hitting a peak, a fevered pitch. And then 2015 and 2016, the bottom fell out. The price of oil dropped, and a lot of mines basically went idle and shut down, laid off workers. Now, oil prices are stabilized. That's the way it's being described, around $50 a barrel or so. But what's happened is a lot of these companies and a lot of the drilling companies in places like North Dakota, Texas, they've learned how to effectively get more oil out of the ground with less money involved. They're doing it cheaper. They've lowered their input costs. So that's all it took. And we're seeing a lot of activity happening down in Texas. The sand mining companies are starting to respond. The demand is coming back up.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, about a legal challenge to the DNR approving a frac sand mining company filling in a wetland here in Wisconsin. So Meteor Timber, again, the company behind this frac sand operation and this plan, what did they say they'd do to offset the loss of these particular wetlands?
Well, the company is really pushing this point. They say that this is an environmental net benefit. They are going to preserve 643 acres of land that they already own that is technically wetlands. So by doing conservation easements, they're placing the land in these easements so that it cannot be developed ever. They say that's one of the benefits. They're also transforming some cranberry bogs back into wetland. Basically, that's a wetland restoration project. And they say that all of this combined is, it's basically a 40 acres of wetlands will be protected for every acre that is disturbed. And again, we're talking about 16 acres of this wooded swamp area.
And now two environmental groups and the Ho-Chunk Nation involved in this case. Why the Ho-Chunk Nation?
Well, the Ho-Chunk Nation has been kind of standoffish about, they've been concerned about industrial sand mining. They've held conferences where people kind of get together and talk about their concerns about things like air quality and, of course, destruction to the environment. It's also very close to or on their the ceded territory, kind of their tribal territory. But in general, they're just not big fans of mining of any sort. they'd rather see the land, you know, left alone.
I want to give a listen to one of the environmental group representatives. Here's Sarah Gears from Midwest Environmental Advocates.
We really believe that this application by Meteor Timber does not comply with the wetland regulatory standards. So we hope to see this DNR decision overturned, and we hope to stop the wetland fill.
So is that the core of the challenge here? They say it didn't meet the wetland regulatory standards. That's why this should be blocked?
Yeah, and some of the specifics of what they're getting at there is that state law was changed back in 2012 so that a company, in this whole wetland mitigation and when it comes to filling a wetland, the first goal with the Army Corps of Engineers or the DNR is to avoid impacts whenever possible. Part of that is where so a company has to look for alternative sites. If there are any alternative sites, they have to consider those and prove why they can't be why they can't use those. And in 2012, the law was changed so that if the company or whoever could prove that the project would provide an economic benefit. That meant, in state law at least, that the company only had to look immediately adjacent to the property that they had originally picked. That's a little complicated, but basically it really limits what the company has to look at as alternatives. So in theory, it makes it easier for companies to fill in the wetlands that they originally want to fill.
What's the next step in this case, Rich?
The next step. So with the there's two things here. There is a the Clean Wisconsin has filed a what is called a contested case, a petition for a contested case hearing. If the DNR accepts that, it goes to an administrative law judge. Everything is put on hold for at least a year, and then they go from there. The law judge will decide whether or not the DNR made the correct choice in giving the permit. The MEA is filed on behalf of the Ho-Chunk Nation, has filed a petition with a circuit court judge to basically have the judge look at it and decide if the DNR made the right decision or not. And that is another process that could take years.
Rich, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you, Reb.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He joined us to share details of the cases environmental groups and the Ho-Chunk Nation are bringing against a frac sand mine in western Wisconsin. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Bill Madison fell in love with the circus as a kid in the 1930s. Though many of us joke about running away to join the circus, Bill actually did it. Though a career in the circus wasn't for him, Bill channeled his passion into lovingly crafted miniatures that fill his Madison home.
When I was 7, 8 years old, my grandparents, the parade went by their house in La Crosse. That's where my parents are from, and so we were up there visiting. So we sat on the curb and watched it go by. It was magic. When I was 13 and 14, right, Natty, my birthday's in August, so it's in the middle of the summer. I wanted to have a little venture with them, so I kind of took off. In 42, World War II had just started, and it was at that period that I connected with ringlings. If you were warm, the circus wanted you because of such a shortage of help immediately, you know, because I wasn't draft age or anything. I was on the backside of the elephants and horses with ringling, you know, cleaning up after them. No, it was a lot of really hard work. You'd start at like 6 in the morning from off of the train, and then you're lucky if you got to bed by, say, 11 or 12 at night. My father knew immediately where I went. And he called the sheriff, and they got telephone call back and forth. And finally, the guy in charge of the comment, Blood was his last name. He got on the phone with my father and my dad and that, and he said, well, I'll have me home in time for school, that I wouldn't miss any school.
When did you actually start building circus models?
The first wagons, what I thought were wagons anyhow, were Kraft cheese boxes. I don't know if you remember those. They were wood. And then I used Chinese checkers for the wheels. You know, you punched a hole in the middle, and that was a wagon. Got acquainted to things in the circus. You start to make them look more like circus wagons. And
Can I see where you do your work?
Absolutely, yeah. It's downstairs.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. You can go first, because if I fall, I have something to land on.
There you go. I'll catch you.
Yeah. Wow. All right, here's the... Say, I'm building in the early 20s, so I like the spoked wheels. They weren't pneumatic wheels, or all of the artwork on them, you know, the carvings and scroll work. They weren't just boxes with Holland tents. Do that. Now, this one is 70-some years old. You can see how the door's warped on it. Now, this is a ticket wagon. This was made out of, you know, balsa wood. See, it doesn't weigh anything. It's just real small. In fact, the wheels aren't even perfectly round because I didn't have a lathe or anything in those days. And I just carved them. Everything's animated. And like the Barker, when a friend of mine who was a Barker in the show, and he did a recording for me. So on the come along on the midway, play that, and it's him talking. It's, you know, professionally done, and that's really neat. I kind of like the wagons that did things. If it was a band wagon, I'd put the band on it, and so it would play. And I made a calliope with a boiler in it, and it generates steam, and I made it whistle so I could play tunes on it. And I really liked making it so that they're as authentic and as accurate as I could. Everything works on all of them.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, when you go to a music venue to catch a band, there's a good chance the people surrounding the production, the band itself, the sound engineer, maybe the booking agent, maybe even the audience, are mostly men. Our next guests are looking to change that, starting at the local level. Tessa Echevarria joins us now. She's the co-owner and engineer at analog recording studio Williamson Magnetic Recording Company. She's a co-founder of the Half Stack Sessions, a group of women dedicated to promoting inclusion and equality in the Madison music community. Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about the mission of Half Stack Sessions.
Yeah, so the mission of the group is to create a space for women and non-binary folk and LGBT musicians to meet up and grow with each other and be able to form projects and, you know, get into music. Maybe someone who's plays but hasn't gone out and played shows or isn't comfortable playing in front of people, you know, a place for them to meet and sort of gather together. And then to take that energy and push it out into the broader scene and see a broader effect at the local level for music venues and shows to have more diversity on bills and booking and audience and ownership and whatnot.
And what were some of the experiences that you and your colleagues had that made you think, yeah, we need something like this?
Yeah, well, so it was founded by four women who are all in bands in the local scene in Madison, mostly in rock and pop bands. And we would get together all the time after shows and we'd be like, oh, we had this terrible experience because, you know, we felt uncomfortable in a show standing in the audience listening to a guy singing a song about how he's going to kill his girlfriend if she leaves him, or somebody gropes you inappropriately, or, you know, how to deal with these things just like as people in shows. And then that leads us to frustrations of never being thought that we're actually in the band, never being taken seriously as musicians or engineers or as people who have their own right to be there and are not just attached to their boyfriend or husband. And we talk about this and, you know, if ebbs and flows as different events happen. And I just started thinking, I was like, you know, I'm tired of being frustrated and I want to do something. So I talked to other women in the scene and everyone was sort of feeling the same way. And we were like, all right, we should start a group where we can work to start affecting change in the areas that we can as, you know, small time musicians that play small venues and not, you know, the larger national scene. And so I wanted it to work from ground up. And that's, you know, just the culture of how people like relate to music and how shows go and how venues are run and how billing and booking is done. And it starts from a young age of what, you know, is acceptable gender-wise for people to play and do and be interested in.
You know, I think a lot of things traditionally seen as male occupations, you know, if you go to the doctor's office, there's a woman doctor, you don't think twice about it anymore. A police officer, whatever, you name it. What is it about rock and pop music that makes it seem like a woman on the stage? Like, why does that still seem weird?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's interesting because in some ways I think that societal-wise, people think of creative professions as more female professions, you know, as not practical, but not the case in music at all. And it is very male-dominated in every aspect. And I think that's the part that people kind of forget. It's not just that the people on the stage are normally male, you know, which is a big part. You go to a show and you see men performing as a young boy, you're like, I'm going to be that one day. You know, you associate yourself with what you're seeing on stage. But it's important to think about that not only are the musicians on the stage, but the producers, the songwriters, the engineers, the people who are running the record labels, the people that are running the venues, those are all also incredibly male-dominated fields. And so they're putting out a certain perspective that they have from being that, and it makes it harder and harder for women to enter into different levels of the music scene or different ways of being part musician or engineer or venue owner because all of the aspects are so male dominated.
Tessa Echevarria is with us talking about the group Half Stack Sessions, aimed at making music scenes more inclusive and equal, including starting here in Madison. And can you talk a little bit? It's not just a matter of there are guys doing this stuff, but actively unwelcome situations sometimes for people who aren't the normal rock and, or what people see as the normal rock and roll guys up on the stage.
Yes, that's definitely true. There's, I think, a idea that goes along with rock and roll that it's a dude thing, that it's, mm-hmm. you know, all about being the biggest man or something. And that's not necessarily what it has to be or what it is. It's one of the reasons that we called our group Half Stack Sessions, is that if you're thinking musically, a full stack is a larger amp and it creates more noise, and a half stack is a softer amplifier. So we're saying that, you know, we're relating that to our experience with female musicians, saying we are not broadcasting as loudly. Like, we are not seen as loud or as rock and roll as our male counterparts, regardless of what music we're actually playing. And that's sort of the metaphor we're using for the group's name.
At a practical level, what kind of things are you doing with Half Stack Sessions?
Yeah, so we have monthly meetings where we get together that are members only. So that's only for women, non-binary folk, LGBT, to come in, and we sort of share experiences. We talk about skill shares. You know, a hard thing as a female musician is, like, people talk about going into Guitar Center or something and just not being taken seriously, like not thinking that they actually want to buy an electric guitar, like not being able to, like, figure out, like, talk about pedals or, like, get a pedal fixed, just, like, a general condescending attitude. So a safe space where people can, like, grow as musicians and, like, start new projects and learn new skills. So that's sort of, like, a small, like, private meeting that we do monthly. And then we just did a event at the Wilmar Neighborhood Center on the east side. We did a showcase of a bunch of different local bands that have females in them. And then also from Milwaukee and Minneapolis, we had two touring bands come in, and it was a fundraiser for DAIS, the Domestic Abuse Prevention Center. And so we raised close to $1,000 at that, and it was sort of like an opening event to everyone to come check out, look at our mission statements and stuff, and talk to us.
As I understand it, the ultimate goal isn't to have a separate women's music scene or women's rock scene, but to have a music scene where everybody is showing up and included.
Yes, definitely. I think our country has definitely established that separate is not equal. But at this point in time, everyone should be on the same page with that. And no, it's not. I think that it's important for oppressed groups to be able to have meeting places that are just there so that they can talk about their frustrations, learn things, ask questions they're not comfortable saying in front of these people. But then it's important to take those conversations and pull them back into the broader context and have that open dialogue and have the whole community involved. You know, I don't want to have a separate show. I want to feel safe at whatever show I go to. And I want to be taken seriously when I go and play whatever venue it is I play.
Of course, Madison's just one part of Wisconsin's music scene. If there are people out there listening in Milwaukee, Fox Cities, Eau Claire, you name it, do you have advice for them on how to start tackling these issues?
Start a group. I mean, anyone is free to contact any of the organizers, Half Stack Sessions, Facebook page, or me personally, and I'd be happy to have personal conversations. We did have a band from Milwaukee, Foxface, come and play our spring showcase, and they were saying, they were like, this is great. This would be amazing if we had something like this in Milwaukee, and it would be great if it spread across the state.
Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tessa Echevarria is the co-owner and engineer at analog recording studio Williamson Magnetic Recording Company. She joined us to talk about Half Stack Sessions, a group of people dedicated to promoting inclusion and equality in the Madison music scene. We pin a lot of hope on medical research, with a lot of public and private money going into basic science and the development of medications and other treatments. The goal is to see cures for life-threatening illnesses. And there have been a lot of success stories over the years, from AIDS medications to chemotherapy. But our next guest says there's a fundamental problem in biomedical research, not just that some diseases remain uncured or that promising treatments fail on closer study. He says a lot of the basic research in biomedicine is fundamentally flawed, leading science up blind alleys, creating false hope, and wasting a lot of money. Richard Harris joins us now. He's a science correspondent at NPR and the author of the new book Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Pleased to be here.
Well, what were some of the first signs you saw that there was a problem with biomedical research?
Well, one of the most notable studies came out a few years ago, and it was done by a researcher who is the head of cancer research at Amgen, a drug company in California. And he decided to take a look at some of the more promising scientific results he saw published in the scientific literature, figuring if these studies are correct, these are great leads for new drugs. But he couldn't get them to work in his laboratory. And after a while, he decided, I'm going to go back and I'm going to try to redo about more than 50 of these experiments, 53, and see if I can get them to work, and even go to the original scientist and say, hey, I'm having trouble with these experiments. Can you help me? And he did as much as he could to see if he could reproduce those 53 studies. And of those, he was only able to reproduce 6. That's 11%. And that was a pretty shocking result. And as it turns out, he was the second person to have done something like that, because at the same time he was doing that work, there was also an experiment going on, a similar experiment at the Bayer drug company in Germany. And they could only reproduce 25% of their experiments. So this was a big red flag for the community at large that, hey, we need to be less confident in the studies that we see published in the scientific literature.
And then that core problem, basic research that nobody seems to be able to replicate, how does that cascade into wasted research time and money?
Well, science is hard, and I'm quite sympathetic to scientists. They're on the frontiers of knowledge, and we shouldn't expect every experiment to be correct, of course. But the real issue is how much of it is wrong, and how do you sort of separate the wheat from the chaff? And that has been the problem. When you have that many experiments or that many published results that are misleading, it can really send the fields in the wrong direction. People can say, oh, here's an exciting result, and they'll start to build on it. And it may take quite a while for them to realize that the original result wasn't correct in the first place. So this is kind of leads to a wasted effort. And you'll always have some wasted effort, but my book focuses on some of the efforts, some of the things that can be done to streamline this process so you have less wasted effort, you have more, you have more results that are published that are correct in the first place, and easier to tell when something is wrong, that it's something that's just not worth pursuing and time to move on to some other idea.
Yeah, you find a lot of causes for this kind of research going wrong, being non-replicable. One point you make is that the ecosystem of basic research in science is often set up for failure. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, this is a sad story of what's happening with the culture of science these days. And in some ways, it's driven by the fact that there's really not enough money to go around. There are so many scientists fighting for a shrinking pool of research dollars. Most times, scientists spend a lot of effort writing a proposal for a new grant to get to fund their research, and most of those are turned down. Even really fine ideas get turned down. So this cranks up the pressure, and unfortunately, it creates a hyper-competitive environment, this quest for money. So all of a sudden, if you need money, you have to say the research that I've done is, you know, sparkling, perfectly clean, and so on, and with dramatic and really interesting results. And it encourages people, unfortunately, often unconsciously, I think, to make their results seem better than they really are, and not to admit their errors and the flaws and the cracks and their uncertainties and so on. And this perpetuates the idea that that things aren't as good as they could be. And the rewards are really for doing stuff quickly, and for maybe not doing that final follow-up experiment that might deflate your results a little bit. And you know, it's, you know, the system, unfortunately, is not geared for optimal science. Scientists really have to choose, do I want to do what's best for my career? And I understand that. They want to keep going, and they want to keep pursuing their ideas. Or do I do, you know, the most careful possible science that might actually harm my career?
And another source of that kind of bias to want to think you've got something significant, you write, is a lot of people go into this line of work because they want to help people. They want to come up with a cure. If they've got that initial result that looks like it could be really promising, there's a part of their brain that says, yeah, run with that. And it trumps the part of their brain that says, let's find out what's wrong with this.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not unique to scientists, of course. We all like to look at the world that way, and it's we see the world as, you know, through our own particular lenses, and I'm totally sympathetic to that. But the scientific process is designed to help scientists avoid those kinds of pitfalls. It's why you're not supposed to know in advance how your results are going to turn out. You're supposed to, it's called, sometimes scientists call it blinding, where you're not aware of whether you're looking at the control studies, the people or the cells that are not expected to change, or the ones that you've treated with a chemical to see if they do change. So there are all sorts of ways that science is designed to avoid these kinds of pitfalls. But there are so many ways that you can fool yourself that it's a really, really challenging task to avoid fooling yourself.
Another source of problems is sometimes in animal studies, you write, the sample sizes are small because they're set not by how many tests would be significant, but by how much the researchers can afford to do.
Yeah, that's another consequence of having not enough money in biomedical research to do things correctly. And the classic example I talk about in the book is involving ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And there have been many, many false leads based on animal studies that were just far too few animals that were mice that were done in these original studies. And people just, you know, to do these studies correctly takes dozens and dozens of mice. And that it can cost, a single experiment can cost well over $100,000. And if you're a researcher dependent upon a federal grant, you're not. It's very difficult to amass that kind of money to do the experiments, you know, with all the bells and whistles. And I don't mean that in that those are excessive things to do. Those are actually the essential things that you need to do to be really confident in your results. And there is an outfit called the ALS Therapy Development Institute that actually does put the resources into doing these experiments correctly. They're based up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they redid a bunch of the experiments that really looked promising and led to a lot of failed experiments for drugs for ALS. And they redid the mouse studies correctly, and they said, oh, we can understand why these experiments failed. If you actually do them with enough mice and you do all of the other careful things you need to do to structure these experiments correctly, they did not see promising results in their mouse studies.
Staying with those mice and other animals, something I actually was kind of surprised to read in your book was a lot of the animals we test on maybe don't tell us that much about what a human is like. We're so different. Even something that might work in mice might not work in rats, much less humans.
It's true. I think we have an exaggerated expectation that, well, we're mammals, they're mammals, therefore what works in them is going to work with us. But cancer's been cured many times in mice. All sorts of diseases have been successfully treated in mice. And then when you try to take them to human beings, it doesn't work. The animals are still valuable available as experimental models for sort of understanding some of the basic parameters of how biology works. But we are very, very different, and very often those don't translate. So I think it behooves us to be really careful when we see experiments results in mice, not to say, oh, this is going to work in people. And unfortunately, we journalists sometimes just get quite excited about experiments that are reporting exciting results in mice. And I think scientists maybe get a little bit overexcited too and think, wow, here's, you know, this is going to pan out. Maybe occasionally they're worthwhile leads, but caution is advised.
We're talking to NPR's Richard Harris about problems with biomedical research. His new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how biomedical research is done? If you or a loved one have participated in a clinical trial for a medication or other treatment, what was that experience like? And if you're involved in health research yourself, what do you think could be done to improve the system? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to NPR science correspondent Richard Harris about research in biomedical sciences. His new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about medical research? Have you been part of the research system as a patient in an experimental study or as a scientist? What did you see? What could work better? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to our callers, Richard, we covered just a few of the reasons that research can go wrong. What are people doing now to try to get over some of the flaws that lead to misguided searches for cures?
Yeah, that's a good question, because actually people are quite concerned about this. Scientists are. And now that they're becoming aware of the problem, they are thinking about what sorts of things they can do. And they're pursuing a bunch of different ideas. And I think some of the most intriguing ones are discussions about how to make science more transparent, so that when a scientist publishes some results, they also put out their original data and their computer code so other people can quickly replicate the experiments and do their own analysis and see if it's correct or not. This is not always popular, because people are worried that they're also giving away some of their intellectual property in the process. But on the other hand, we as taxpayers, generally speaking, fund this stuff. So I think it's fair game to say, let's put it out there and let people talk about that. So that's one idea. I think another thing that I saw hopeful signs of is scientists realizing that young scientists needed to be trained a little bit better on this, because they don't necessarily get formal training on the best way to design an experiment and how to avoid all of these various pitfalls. So there's a new interest and focus on improving scientific education for graduate students and beyond. So some of these avoidable problems will be avoided.
Let's go to our callers now. Vicky is on the line in Oregon. Vicky, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if the increase in the pseudoscience has made it harder for true scientific researchers to get funding, because they're competing with people who are competing for money from people who think that, you know, vaccines cause autism, or and therefore science is flawed, or, you know, this and such new superfood is going to cure cancer, and, you know, people aren't going to okay spending money on research, because science is just trying to make us sick kind of thing. Mm.
Well, the National Institutes of Health, which doles out the most of this research dollars for this kind of work, and they give more than $30 billion a year out or spend on their own campus, that process is a very careful process. And it's actually, they recruit scientists from around the country to sit and judge these experiments that come in. So I think the NIH is not diverting money to dubious scientific experiments. If anything, I think the NIH process does is very conservative. And sometimes scientists complain that the more interesting, sort of far out there ideas that are well grounded in science actually don't stand a chance against sort of safer experiments that are more likely to succeed. And so some people wish that the NIH would be a little bit looser just to allow some of these somewhat unorthodox ideas in, because sometimes those are the ones that yield the biggest results. But we're not talking about oddball theories. We're talking about, you know, real science, but just unusual sort of off-the-beaten-path kinds of ideas.
Vicky, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Andy in Manitowish Waters. Andy, hi.
Hi. Mine's going to be a little bit different. I was a superintendent on a construction project about 14 years ago, and it was a building for raising hogs for organ transplants. Building was probably in the neighborhood of $10 million. And we were 2 weeks from completing the project, and someone said to the drug company, did you run this past the FDA? And they said, no, we should probably do that. Well, they got turned down, and the building sat empty for 5 years.
Hey, Andy, thanks. Wow. That sounds like a lot of money wasted. I don't know. That's maybe even beyond the research scale. But, Richard, any thoughts on that?
No, that's a fascinating story. I hadn't heard that.
So do you see, Richard, as we start to wrap up, I mean, is there a culture change since those two studies you mentioned at the outset came up that, hey, we're starting to move in the right direction here?
Well, I think there's clearly an interest in doing that. And in fact, the NIH has put out some new rules to say, hey, if you're going to be using, for example, living cells, you need to verify that the cells are what you think they are, because quite often scientists think they're using, for example, a liver cancer cell, when in fact they're studying a cervical cancer cell, because they haven't bothered to actually verify the identity of the cells. And the NIH is saying, enough of that. That's an easy problem to fix. From this point on, we expect you to verify your cells. So they're very practical things like that that are happening. There are also scientists who are, you know, thinking the big thoughts and sort of saying, how do we change the culture of science? And it's hard because it's driven by the funding crunch, and that's not easy to fix for sure. But sort of these cultural ideas that have crept in, cultures don't change quickly, but they can change. And in fact, there were somewhat similar problems to these that were plaguing clinical research, that is, experiments with human beings of new drugs and so on, back in the 1990s. And there were a lot of avoidable problems with those experiments. And people swept through that. They looked at those systems, and they've cleaned that up quite a bit, actually. Not perfect, but that is much improved. And so the people who were involved in some of those projects to improve that process are now turning their attention to these laboratory results and saying, look, if we can get higher success rates from these laboratory results, that means we can accelerate the progress in developing new drugs. We can avoid a lot of the dead ends, the missing, the bad directions, and so on. And basically, we get more bang for the buck, more value for the research dollars we're putting in. Research, as I say, research is hard. You're never going to be perfect or close to it. But the trick is to, you know, recognize when you're on the wrong track and make an adjustment.
We'll leave it there, Richard. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Rob. Thanks.
That was Richard Harris, science correspondent at NPR. We've been talking about his new book, Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. A growing number of local governments in Wisconsin are getting behind a private loan program that helps homeowners and businesses install energy-efficient and renewable energy devices. The trend comes as the federal government is backing away from international efforts to save energy and reduce emissions that can contribute to climate change. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The path to big improvements in energy efficiency often starts in the basement, and that's true at the former Wally Schmidt Tavern near downtown Milwaukee. Developer Julie Kaufman heads down the stairs to talk about what's happened since her coalition of investors bought the foreclosed building 18 months ago.
We inherited basically ineffective, unusable dinosaur stuff that was from like the 1930s. And what you can see now here in the basement is a super energy efficient furnace, which provides effective heating to the building at a much more delivery efficiency.
Kaufman next points to a new, more efficient water heater. The three-story building also has upgraded windows, LED lighting, more insulation, and a green roof. Kaufman says the improvements cost about $150,000, or about 20% of the overall project price tag.
In the scheme of things, the incremental value to get the greater efficiency was not a huge leap, but it was certainly a strain on the project, and having this kind of financing really closed that piece of the gap so we could do the efficiency and do it well from the beginning.
The financing Kaufman mentions comes through the Milwaukee version of a national initiative called PACE, or Property Assessed Clean Energy. The program requires $1 in energy savings for every dollar invested. Nicole Robin is with the Milwaukee lending firm PACE Equity. Robin says there's always some uncertainty when you give out money.
Given the fact that the building had been foreclosed and was, you know, vacant for a while, I think there's some risk in there. But we believe in Julie as a developer. We believed in the mission of the revitalization of this building. We saw what systems she was putting in place, so we saw the energy efficiency.
Julie Kaufman will use her annual energy savings of about $10,000 to pay the loan back over up to 20 years through a special assessment on her property tax bill. The city of Milwaukee then sends PACE Equity the money. The city's environmental sustainability director, Eric Schambarger, says 8 redevelopment projects worth $13 million have used PACE. He says the program is both a great way to revive historic buildings and address climate change.
Regardless of what you feel about the politics of all this, we're helping building owners cut waste and become more efficient and invest in the building itself rather than something that's as ephemeral as energy.
The energy efficiency investments also pay off with some customers. On the first floor of the former Wally Schmitz, there's now a restaurant called The Tandem. Diner Venus Williams says the food is great, and so is the building going green.
Everything matters in this community, the people, how we honor sun and moon and all of the natural resources that are available to us, how we recycle and reuse and rebuild.
Milwaukee was the first Wisconsin community to start using PACE in 2013. State legislation passed a few years ago made a slightly different version of the program available elsewhere, and 18 counties now have PACE, with 4 signing on in just the last 2 months. UW Extension Energy Program Manager Sherry Gruder acknowledges 3/4 of Wisconsin counties still aren't in the program, but she thinks she knows why.
You can't become a part of it unless you've passed a resolution. So, you know, the wheels of government turn slowly.
Gruder helped spread the word about PACE and other local financing options for saving energy during a workshop at last weekend's Midwest Renewable Energy Fair near Stevens Point. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.